Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Shall we start it?
Yeah. I'm so mad we can't do roll call. This is such a roll call episode. It's really.
Are you rolling,
Amir?
Yep, Amir, I'm rolling now.
I will think of a solution so we can get back to roll call.
Audio movers.
Can you work on?
I actually thought of one today. Like we can just do our own verse by ourselves. Like we can say that and the Supreme is ourselves.
But the whole thing is the reaction to
what the other person said.
Yeah, exactly. And then our guest wants to hear ours, so they can kind of get an idea sometimes.
Well, okay, I'll think of something.
I got a good idea. We go back into a studio in person with people, and we do our roll calls there.
No, I'm good on that.
Fonte don't want that. All right,
I'm good on that.
Fonte, you can always be even if we're live all together in a studio with a guest.
Patch me in.
Yeah, we just patch you.
I'm with it.
Can we make Fonte like Max Headroom though? Like he's just like on a TV, you can just see his head.
Can I start the show, please?
Okay.
No small talk? Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen. That was the small talk. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove, and the Supreme team is with me, Scrong. All five of you, or four of you. I still don't know the proper number. Anyway, unpaid bill. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Yes.
You too, friend.
I think you're doing big things in your life right now. What you got going on?
Thanksgiving, Grammys, movies. Okay. That's it.
Good.
That's all you can ask for in life.
Hey, man. Front I'm as many jobs as you do. I'm good.
How's life
I'm
with
good.
You, sir?
Life is good, brother. I'm good. Still dropping. I kind of at the point where you were at, where I kind of hit a plateau in my joint.
Plateau, right?
So I'm down probably like 30. Right now I'm down probably like 37, you know what I mean? And so I've been just switch it up a little bit. I'm going to start going meatless maybe like 1 or 2 days a week just to try, you know, see what's
okay.
So we're switching it up a little bit.
Well, I'm about to let you know this, what am I having? I got dandelion, garlic, spinach, and cucumber. So hopefully this will do the trick and get me off that plateau. I'm plateauing.
I was just gonna eat some sweet potatoes, but
yeah, I'm gonna drink less whiskey.
I see.
That'll do it. That'll do it. Yeah, alcohol will put it on you.
Laia,
how are you? I'm good. Still got the three jobs. Moving down to where the black folks live in LA. Real excited.
Oh yeah, you got a new apartment. Talk about
it. Come on. I'm going
this
down. Brand, moving
this
down.
This is a new apartment you're in right now.
Yeah. No, this is my mama house. But in LA, I got me a nice spot. So now my parents got another bed to sleep in. I ain't got to sleep on the couch. And I'm down where the black folks live.
Where do black people live in LA? Just let our listeners know.
If they're lucky, they live in South LA, Inglewood. You know, I'm in Leimert by the Drum Circle and whatnot, which is kind of like really dope. It's
Leimert,
being highly gentrified right now because that's where the stadium is and they're putting in the train. So LA is really expansion gentrification on level 3.
The football stadium?
Yeah, it's so kind.
Yeah, I went there to see the last Rolling Stones LA show.
Yeah, I hear it.
And
nice.
I didn't realize they dropped that joint like right in the middle of the hood.
Yeah, right in Inglewood.
Like, the second you step off the pavement, you're definitely in Inglewood.
Yes, don't you love it? As long as the people can afford to stay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, right in the middle of it. Steve? Mm-hmm. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. How are you? Okay.
Where am I?
How are you? Right. I said, yeah.
Oh, I'm.
I know
I'm
where
fine.
You are.
I'm good.
Okay, we
just
can edit
let,
that part
you know,
out.
Let your many followers know that you're good.
Yeah.
Everything's boss man, and congrats on the witch call. We forgot to congratulate you.
The Oscar.
Well, the Oscars and all that, but then the short film you did for
Jay-Z's.
Jay-Z doing skills. Shout to y'all, man.
I need to follow you.
Director.
Oh, okay. You didn't realize I directed a second film. Like,
no,
you know,
busy man.
Sometimes when there's a little buzz on you, then people start and you know, I got a call from Team Hove to settle. Well, the thing was is that I knew without something on that level, he would not come to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I told the staff, let me direct something and that will lure him to it. Without that, he wouldn't have come. He would have just, you know, phoned in a speech.
Well, congrats on both of them, getting both
Thank
things
you.
Done.
All right, this is probably the longest Wow, we've never gone 4 minutes without even acknowledging our guest right now.
We haven't talked in a while. We sorry, guest. We haven't talked in a while.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Yeah, we ain't seen each other.
Okay, so what I will quickly say about our guest today is if I were compiling a list of the most charismatic figures in hip-hop or maybe in music, I wouldn't hesitate to put this gentleman would probably, and I'm trying to keep the Questlove hyperbole down to a minimum. He's probably, if not in my top three, maybe he's my number one most charismatic figure that I know in hip hop. And the evidence of that for me is, and I'm going beyond hip hop, I'm going to music. The evidence is in the 35 years that I've been fortunate enough to see him perform throughout those decades, I've never not seen him elevate any event to the highest level. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never seen him walk in any situation with fear or trepidation. It's, and to me, like, you know, I'm a guy who will overthink, like, oh, I can't go out there. I you know, they don't know who I am, whatever. Like, forget generational, forget genre. I've seen him rock with, you know, Prince, Tom Cruise, Heavy D, Chuck Brown, like from every genre. He's the most charismatic. And, you know, Snoop is charismatic. Will Smith's charismatic. I can name a gazillion. Jay-Z's charismatic. But, you know, our guest today is
the world's greatest entertainer.
Yes, literally. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is officially known for the and not for the. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for Doug E. Fresh on Questlove Supreme.
Yes.
Wow. Hey, let me tell you, it is an honor. It is an honor. And I appreciate y'all giving me, or rather having such a long delay on the introduction. Cause I felt like I got caught up with all of y'all too. And I felt like it was a family conversation. And I was able to hear it close up in person, you know. So yeah, thank you. And thank you for having me on your show, Quest. I appreciate it. The Supreme Team, and that name Supreme Team.
Oh, I already
know. In hip hop, for y'all to use that name is a very powerful thing, because back on WHBI, it was the world famous Supreme Team show. Mm-hmm. Peace, Allah, and justice.
Yes. Right. I heard those tapes. Yes.
That's right. I know you did. That's why, look, you are the ultimate collector. So I know that when I mention something like that, you would you either know it or you would appreciate it. You know, absolutely. So I appreciate you. And I appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you. You know
what? I think, even though I'm going to start before that, I do believe that you are indeed, and I think about till today, you are indeed the first beatboxer the world has seen, because I believe that your cameo in Beat Street did predate the Fat Boys. So even though, you know, a lot of the world credits Buffy, rest in peace to Buffy, definitely as the first beatboxer they ever seen. If we really look at the timeline for all of us hip hop heads that saw Beat Street in 1983, the Disco 3 Fat Boys didn't come out until 1984. So technically, and it's weird, I don't think at the time, and I remember the Christmas rap from Beat Street, I think at the time you might have been so effortless and doing what you were doing, I don't think it even registered to us that you were doing drums with your mouth.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And it was a funny scene. It was us trying to make people kind of laugh and feel good. But it's deep that you picked that up, because I actually did the movie at the time, because there was a scout who went up to Savoy Manor. And I was performing on that show with the Crash Crew, Mastodon, and the Deaf Committee. And I believe at that, I don't think the Force MCs was on that show at the time, but I performed there, and then she gave me a card. And when she gave me a card, it said Beach Street on it. She said, do you want to be in a movie? Because what you're doing would be unbelievable to see in a movie. And I'm going to tell you some information. So I went there and he started to see what I do. And he was like, I don't care what I got to do. I got to get you in this movie. Now, originally, Run DMC was supposed to be in Beach Street.
What?
And that's what I'm telling you. I think you, you know, I'm going to give you the pieces that I know you like.
Yeah, let it go.
You like this kind of stuff. I know you like this.
This is all we live for. This is all we live for.
Yeah, I know. Well, y'all done ran to the right. Y'all done ran in the right store tonight. Cause this
let's go.
And by the way, and everything is free. Just by the way, just so you know, it's
not just information. Thank you.
It's just free. So you know. So right. So but this is how it went. I was supposed to do when I was doing Beach Street. Harry Belafonte wanted me to do something where this thing with the beatbox could be showcased. So what happened is Run DMC and Russell came up there and they were going to be in Beach Street. But right. I don't think Russell felt good about them just doing a little segment in it. He wanted them to do more. And then and then it was me, Run, in the elevator and DMC and in the room. So they started doing one of their records, the rhymes to the second album that came out, the beat that sound a little bit like Suck MCs. I don't know the exact song, but they was saying the rhymes.
That was on the King of Rock album?
The next album, right. Yeah, right.
The last song on side two.
It got the... Yeah, it got a little kind of thing to it. So right. I'm in the elevator and we start doing it. And he said, and he looked at Russell and he said, yo, this would be crazy. We should get Doug to do the beatbox on this and we could do this whole thing in the movie. And then we started coming up with the idea to do it. And then Harry was excited about it. But then Russell pulled out. And after he pulled out, then he brought in Treacherous 3. And when he brought in Treacherous 3, Treacherous 3 knew me as a kid. Because they knew me from going into Bobby Robinson's record shop all the time. Yeah. So when they seen me, they said, hey, you know, Harry said, Mr. Belafonte said, you know, is it any way that you can have Dougie do this with you? Because I think this routine is unbelievable. So if you listen to the rhyme, they mentioned me multiple times in the rhyme. He said, you know that kid Dougie Fresh from down the block? Because I really live down the block. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay. Wow. You were their label mates too, because the
right.
The original.
Well, I was. Yeah. No. Just Having Fun came out on Enjoy. Okay. But what happened is that was after, you know, Treacherous 3 was already established. But I let out Just Having Fun, and I did the movie because. At the time, I felt like I needed to let people understand the beatbox and I needed to do something. And I started to see a lot of people trying to, you know, kind of go there with it. And in the time we grew up in hip hop, it was about being as original as possible. So if you did something, it would be considered biting. But see, biting was only considered bad because the only way to make hip hop survive and to be pure creatively, it was necessary for you to feel that kind of pressure. So if somebody say you're a biter, that was kind of like the worst thing that you can ever be called in your life. You know what I mean? It was crazy.
I see. Well, yeah. Okay.
And the beatbox was made up in 80. I introduced it in 82, but I made it up in 81. See, because really? I started in 81 at Harlem World. That's where I started. And and when I made it because I used to play the trumpet. And when I played the trumpet, there was a teacher in my class named Brother Lee. Okay. Brother Lee was, I went to IS-201. And Brother Lee, really quick, Brother Lee was in there and he said, what do you want to play? And I pointed to the percussions and the drums. He said, well, you can't play that yet. You got to play the trumpet. I said, well, why you ask me, Brother Lee? I mean, come on, baby, damn. And he said, I understand. He said, but I want you to play the trumpet. So I took the trumpet home every day. And when I took the trumpet home, I would practice it, take the mouthpiece, boil it, do the whole thing, do all of the exercises. And then one day when I came back to school, Brother Lee was gone because they cut all the music programs in school. So I gave them the trumpet back and I was still walking home. And when I was walking home, I would pass by the mom and pop record shops. So at that time, Grandmaster Flash had out. It was a Friday night. Everybody was breaking the highs. Yeah. Was right. Mm-hmm. And super I would rapping. Always hear, right, there you go. And I would always hear the bass line. And when I would hear the bass line, then all of a sudden I hear all of these other things. So I would walk back and forth and I would just kind of try to keep adding more and more and more ideas to the beat, to the point that I had maybe 7, 8, 9 things going on at the same time. I'm up there going, and I'm going crazy now, but I'm not thinking about it, right? I'm telling you, it's a true story. I'm not thinking about it. So then I go to Barry's house where we used to practice because Barry me B. and Will, Barry B.
Barry B. is riding with
right.
me.
That's right. We go over there and practice because that was the practice house. Long story short, I'm in there doing the beatbox and I'm doing, I think I was doing Impeach the President because it was like, right? And I'm doing Impeach the President. And then all of a sudden, his mother comes in the room and says, that was a nice beat. I like that beat that was playing. And he said, Mom, that wasn't the record. That was him. And now he said, that was him. And she said, well, whatever it was a nice beat. And then he turned around and looked at me and said, yo, you know what? You should do that in the big park tomorrow. Because Mike and Dave was throwing jams out in the big right. park. He said, yo, you should call it the human beatbox. I said, I'm not going to do that. That's crazy. I'm not doing that. You're trying to make me look crazy? He said, I'm telling you. Yo, what you just did was crazy. So then I went out to the big park. And when I did it, everybody lost their mind. And that was the beginning of the beatbox.
And that was 1981?
That was 1981?
Okay, 82. What borough did you premiere that in?
I premiered it in Harlem. I premiered it in Harlem. And then after, which was a fascinating piece that I think you'll appreciate too, is that Curtis Blow mm-hmm. came out with 125th Street, the people and the concrete. And it was on... You know, you're
yeah, right,
I know. You know. So what happened, craziest story. I was doing the beatbox. I was on flyers with the Cold Crush, Busy Bee, with the Funky Four, with Fantastic, with Treacherous Street Fearless. Like, I'm rolling now. So now what happened is Curtis Blow was outside, and this was the first time Harlem Week had somebody. Curtis Blow was the first hip-hop artist to perform at Harlem Week. Before that, it was never no hip-hop. So when Curtis Blow was there, they forgot to give him turntables because it wasn't normal.
Right.
So I'm walking down the street. When I'm walking down the street, they see me. Yo, that's Dougie Fresh right there. Yo, Dougie, come over here. And Curtis said to me, he said, Dougie, is it possible for you to get on and do the beatbox for me because I have no turntables? The band, there's no band. The band only know how to play for whoever's getting on next.
Right.
There's no CD. There was no cassette. There was nothing. And I was standing there. I was like, this is crazy. Curtis Blow is asking me to get on with him. Are you crazy? I was like, Mr. Blow, no problem, sir. I'm ready to do that if you need me. Right. So then I got on. And when I got on, Frankie Crocker was on BLS. And this is when Harlem Week was big. So it was right. probably like 15,000 people outside. I got on and I did the beatbox. And that was the first time Curtis Blow heard the beatbox. And that was way before the Fat Boys.
Okay.
See, that's why I'm giving you that piece.
I get it.
And then I asked him later. I said, Kurt, when you did this and you know that I create, you know that I did this. I said, it didn't feel a little funny with you in there doing. He said, Dougie. You know, he just asked me to come in and produce. And he said, like, it's not enough. I said, no, I'm not mad at you. I said, I'm not mad at you, but I'm just trying to understand. I said, did you? He said, Dougie, it was just so crazy. I was under so much pressure. I was like, I said, don't worry about it, man. I said, I just wanted to know. You know what I mean? Because if I did it for you, you called me to do it, then it was kind of strange for me to hear that you produced the Fat Boys, and then the tradition in hip hop was not about you. When you do something, see, you are you're trying to create your own signature. You were looking to do, and I didn't mean to do the beatbox. Right. I just, it found me.
But there had to be a life lesson in that, though, Doug. Don't you feel like at the end of the day, since you were so young and that happened to you, you feel like in retrospect, was there some type of life lesson in that?
Yeah, you know what's interesting with the life lesson? I always feel this way, and this is the truth. I say to myself, if the music program was never cut at IS-201 and Brother Lee was no longer there, would I have created the beatbox? I don't know. And then on top of that, what's really fascinating is Brother Lee, later on I found out, is Malcolm Lee's father.
Wow.
And on top of that, Brother Lee is also a jazz musician whose brother is Spike Lee.
Yes, I knew you were Billy. Bill Lee's
brother. Yes. Bill Lee was your teacher?
No, his brother, right? His brother.
Oh, his brother. Malcolm Lee's father was my music teacher. And then guess what? Mm-hmm. When I made my records and I came out, I found out. I said, I got to talk to Brother Lee.
And I'm going to ask you about that guitar, though. What was you going to say?
Well, about the trumpet. About the trumpet.
Yeah, with the trumpet. I'm sorry, about the trumpet.
I said, Brother Lee, I'm getting ready to perform at Madison Square Garden. I said, I want you to know that I made up this thing called the beatbox. And I made it up because of you having me play the trumpet. And I said, you know, I want you to perform with me at the Garden. He said, Dougie, I'm so proud of you. He said, but man, I don't know if I can handle performing at the Garden. He was a jazz musician. He said, that might be too much for me. I said, well, I just want you to know that what you did and what happened from the way all of these things landed, turned this thing into something that in hip hop we call the fifth element. And I just want you to know that you are the reason, or one of the reasons, how this thing became what it is. And it was the deepest thing in the world. And then I wound up working with his son, Malcolm, on Girl Trip. And and it's fascinating how all of this ties together.
So dope, man.
Yeah. I have a theory, especially in hip hop. Those who pioneer, those who go first, really never get the glory. Those who go second always get the shine. So, yes, I think in this case, because we technically think of you as the second, you also improved on beatboxing. Even though you were the first, and even though you came out with a single, the original human beatbox, whatever.
Right.
I still say that, you know, it's a good thing you came second, because I don't know why, but it's just like, you know, Marley Marl started the noise thing, but then the Bomb Squad came in and really started the noise thing.
They went there.
Beastie's first white rappers. And yeah, they had success, but Eminem really, like, whoever does it second in hip hop always capitalizes it better. We got to start from the beginning. First of all, where were you born? Where were you born?
I was born here in the U.S., but as a kid, I was taken back and forth to Barbados. So it's kind of like you would consider it kind of like a dual citizenship in a kind of a way, you know, because as a kid, that's how my parents kind of moved. And then my grandfather's from Trinidad and my grandma's from Barbados. So they was kind of, they didn't know whether I should stay in Barbados or should I be in.
So then I'll ask you then, when people are asking you about the origins of hip hop and being as though a lot of the first generation of that culture came from the islands, do you, what is your true belief on where hip hop was born? Is it the Bronx, or do we have to say that technically, you know, the composites of all the residents of the islands, that's where it was born? And what are you seeing on these islands that lead you? Because something's happening there that's bringing it to America. So,
right, right. It's a very interesting question. Well, my sister introduced me to hip hop here in the U.S., but my family was so diverse in their music selection that it made it easy for me to take soca, reggae, and go-go, and R&B, and all of these other musics. And it was just one of these things where you're influenced by all of these things, but in the form of hip hop in the way that I learned it, because I am the first child of the first generation in hip hop, meaning that I am the beginning of like all of these people that came before me. I learned from DJ Hollywood. So my sister came home and said, there's this guy named DJ Hollywood who's rapping. I said, let me hear what he say. She said, he go, ring-a-ding-a-ding, da-dong, da-dong, dong, da-dang, da-dang, dang, da-ding, da-dong, dong, to the hip, hop, she-wop, the bop, before anything I've ever heard. And when she told me, say it again, and I'm trying to catch it. Then my brother brought in a tape with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And when he brought these pieces in, and then my family lived in the Bronx and also in Harlem. So the point I'm making is that in the form that I learned hip hop here, meaning like, I think the influence goes back way further than we really understand. Mm-hmm. But the pieces that I learned from watching Hollywood, watching Love Bug Starsky, being able to sit on the side of the stage at Harlem World when Busy B battled Kumo D, being there in the contest, I was in that contest in 81. Right. Mm-hmm. So we were taking all of these elements as far as like, where did it originate? It originated in Harlem. It originated in the Bronx. It originated in Brooklyn. There was movements going on all over.
Do you guys attribute, since we have some historians here, I'm curious. I'm like, do you attribute any of this to like scatting and at all? Or do you just go straight to the...
Well, that's what I'm saying on the levels. Because see, if you're looking at it on the levels that I'm talking about, you could say Calypso and Soca are original storytellers. You could say Yellow Man and Nicodemus, and you can go back even further than that, but just use them as a blueprint. I'm getting married in the morning. You know, like all of these different pieces is what made up what we do. And then even, and this is my experience, you know, that I seen all of these elements come together and they were influencing me whenever I would go to a certain borough. In the Bronx, I would get a particular kind of hip hop. When I'm in Harlem, I watch Hollywood burn the Apollo down. See, Hollywood is the architect of crowd participation. And I learned the skill directly from him. So I know things about it that nobody, you will never know this because it doesn't exist. And he had it, he gave it to me, and I understand the dynamics of it that like maybe another kid might not, like Fat Man Scoop grew up watching me. Right. So he understands some of the dynamics of it. So what I'm saying is that it just kept evolving because everybody was doing it in their own experience. So I can only respond to the experience that I had, but I was in all of the boroughs, most of the boroughs, studying it, you know?
Okay, so that leads me to what I said at the top of the show, which is the thing that I admire and the thing that I want to learn from you the most. Tariq actually learned this from you. You have a way of commanding the crowd that's not forced, because usually in hip-hop, people have to... At least the modus operandi. Yeah, the modus operandi rule is basically like come at full 12,000% yelling and the idea of what you imagine like Freddie Fox to be like chew off the microphone. But you okay, so the thing that made me pay attention to your crowd control. And the thing is like the one level that I lack in my life journey is the ability to really communicate in a way that I'm not in my head. Like, you know, cause this is the thing, like right before I address a crowd or whatever, suddenly I'm in my head like, oh man, right. I want to look like a nut out here. So what wow. I want to know is I'm certain now that this is like your fourth decade in the industry that now you just do it out off of muscle memory. Like, you know how to capture the crowd, but in those first 10 years, like even without the show and Lottie Dottie, like right. in those first 10 years, how are you psyching yourself up? Because you to me are like hip hop's true version. I see Mos Def do this also. You're the true version of like when I watch a comedian do crowd work, you know,
right.
even without a single, without a song, you walk on the stage, you know how to engage the crowd, how to talk to them, things to do. And it always works. Like, right. I know you've seen, you learned it from Hollywood, but for the first 10 years, like the first 5 years, say, okay, right before the show, 84, you're doing crowd work. Like, what are you saying to yourself before? Like, are you ever nervous in any situation? Like, ah, oh, damn, who I got tonight? A bunch of white people at a corporate party. Like, how do I do this? Like,
wow. Right. I remember we did that. We did a corporate party together one time. I remember that time.
All the time. There's no crowd you can't rock. So what is your, what is your motivational? I need the motivational talk on how you deal with crowd work and why do you do it so well?
I used to host the Apollo. When a singer come out and he sing and I watched him practice before he got on, he'll be like this. I believe in you. He's singing the notes and everything is tight. His pitch is perfect. When the showtime starts and he walks out there, I believe it. And the audience boo right before he even finishes. It's because they feel the frequency of fear. Mm. And when they smell it and they feel it, they automatically get out of here, man. Yo, we ain't here for
you. Don't believe it. You don't believe it. So why should we believe it?
Get out. Yo, who's next? Now, if it's a little kid, it's fascinating. Little kid get up there and he'll be like, I believe. They'll be like, all right, come on, shorty, you going to do it. Let's go. Yeah, yeah. It's encouragement because he's a younger kid. You see what I'm saying? And they don't want to boo him because they want to build him up to become as great as they see him, having the confidence to at least get up on that stage. But if it's a person who is coming up there, and you start singing and they feel fear, the frequency automatically makes them boo. So through these little lessons, I advanced the technology that I learned from Hollywood and I learned from Love Bug and Busy Bee. And I was able to change. I guess, like you said, I played with it so much that I don't even think about the frequency. I feel the frequency and I just respond to the frequency, or I make the frequency what I want it to be.
What you want it to be.
Right. And I bring you to that frequency. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Can you tell us what you feel like in your body as this is going on? Like, are in your body or whole
tell
time?
Us, how do you talk yourself out of fear? Okay.
All right. Or Tariq, do that.
No. Well, for real. All right. So
that's a great question.
As of this taping, Tariq has left the Tonight Show for 4 months. So thus forcing me in a position where I have to address the audience, something I hate doing. Ladies,
right.
I don't know if it's that I feel Hollywood or feel, you know, like, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Root Show.
Well, see, that's the part right there. That's the part right there where it goes wrong. See, the fear is because you're doing something and being something that's not as authentic as you. So the key is to be you and to be you as best, like be you and enjoy being you and don't make it like you're trying to fit into something and replace it. Don't replace anything. Just be you. And the energy is so honest that people will feel that frequency and they will accept it and make it what it is. Like the same way, like your conversation now is so real that it's making me respond to you like I'm responding. because I can feel what you're saying. And because I feel it, it makes me talk to you like this. And that is the same thing you have to do. And fear comes from your thinking. Don't think, feel it and be you. When you think, that's where fear lives. Fear lives in thought. Fear can't exist when it's just pure energy and truth. See, fear and fear and truth can never be in the same room together, because truth exposes fear. You see what I'm saying? So as much as you be yourself, fear can't be around. Like right now, I'm telling y'all the truth. And it doesn't matter to me how you feel about my truth, because it's truth. Now, if I was fearful, it's because I want you to feel a particular way about me. But I'm not concerned with your feelings right now. I'm only concerned with making sure you feel the truth. And when you feel the truth, you can determine how you feel about me. You may like me, you may not, but guess what? You know what you're going to get when you deal with me. You understand?
The truth.
Right. I'm saying it in this way to make you understand that your truth is good. Your truth is good. And you don't, Tariq, like he, that's his space. But your space is, you know, you're coming from a completely different space. And that space you're coming from, it's a good space. You just don't know it because you haven't been using it. You understand what I'm saying?
I'm being forced to use it right now. So, you know, we will see how it goes until March.
I feel like at some point, even for Dougie Fresh,
yeah,
there's an energy in your body that you may have to either suppress for the moment or figure, you know what I mean? Like it's something different going on in here sometimes than out there to get to what they need, but give them what they need.
Right. You're always, you know, the reason why the energy is not bothering me because my level of focus is on what I want. And what I want is I want to save a life. I want to fix this problem. See, what happens is this. When people are dealing, and this is fascinating how this all ties in together, because see, when a person panics, the panic stops them from making a decision that they would have made if they didn't panic. So if a person can focus on what they're doing, panic can't get in because you're focused on what you're doing. Now you'll feel things. Panic could be at the door knocking, but you're focused. And it's part of a technique. Like even like when I work out, right? Say I run and I don't use no music. And sometimes what I do is when I'm running, I'm taking my mind and I'm focusing on something and I'm training it to focus on that. And you know how the mind works. There's always a new thought that come in. Even when somebody's talking to you, there's a new thought. But I train my mind to block all the things and I am focused on that. And when I'm ready, I will let you tell me what I will let. And I hope I ain't bugging y'all out. But
Okay.
I will decide when I want that thought to come in, and I decide if I want that thought or use that thought, because the focus is what I'm looking at. And in order for me to be effective at that thing that I'm doing, I have to stay focused. If I'm performing and something is going on and I'm not focused on the audience, let's say, I'm too divided. You know what I mean? I'm trying to, you know, get this happening. I'm trying to get my man in the club. I'm trying to make sure my girl is situated. I'm trying to make sure, yo, sound man. Like, it's too much. So if you're able to take and focus on something, the impact of it is powerful. And then when you're focused on it and you train your mind to think like that, then what happens is that there's no fear in it because you're focused and there's no panic because that thing you're focused on is the only thing that matters.
Think about.
Are you big on meditation?
I was about to say a mirror sounds like what we talk about all the time.
I don't have no problems with it, but I guess in a form, I do a kind of, I guess it's like a form of meditation. Because when I'm running, I may be running for 70 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes. And every time my mind is trying to take me someplace else, I'll be like, no, we're staying here.
That is, yeah, you're doing it.
Yeah, jogging is definitely grabbing a form of meditation.
And I put it right back. I go like this, no, right here. And then I practice it so much to the point that people don't know how hard it is to think about the same thing for 10 minutes with any interruptions. Just 10 minutes.
Right.
If they try to meditate, they know it ain't, it's, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's what it, yeah. So I kind of incorporate that in a lot of things because I feel like fear is not real, but it's real to you when you're going through it. So if I'm able to, you know, control the outcome by my focus, then fear can't get in there. So if I'm dealing with a situation like City College, if I'm dealing with a situation where I see somebody who got shot at a club or a family member, instead of me panicking, I'm focused and I deal with that. And it's, I'm so focused that I'm not allowing nothing to stop me. And anybody that's giving me anything, I can hear when it's something I need. But if it's, oh my God, I can't, I don't need that. You know, meaning like if you said, "Yo, Doug, I got a ride for so-and-so," I can hear you and I would grab the person and put them in the ride. So it's a focus, but being able to understand what's necessary. I don't know if I went too far with this, but I mean, you know.
Nah, it's an earful.
Yeah, question for you, Doug, because you've, you know, in terms of your faith, because we know that you've been involved with like Scientology for a while. Is that having that kind of focus? Is that something that, you know, you learned in that faith? How does that help you as an entertainer?
It's funny. That's a real good question, bro. You know what? I didn't get that from Scientology. I discovered it from just running, you know, and I run like my running is the thing I love to do, you know? So when I'm running, I started to discover how my mind is all over the place trying to keep itself busy because I'm trying, you know, you're running and you're trying to breathe. And so all of a sudden I say, yo, the mind is panicking. Yo, Dougie, why are you pushing me like this? Yo, you know this is too heavy. Yo, why you got me? And then I'll go like this, shut up, bro. Like, let's say, like, shut up. Be like, all right. And then I'll be like, we doing this right here. And now I want you to relax. Don't panic and breathe. And not to the degree to say, if I needed to slow down, you slow down. But don't panic. See, that's the part, that piece right there.
Right.
Don't panic. You see what I'm saying?
I was going to say,
a good buddy of mine is actually your tour DJ, my man DJ Skills. That's my guy.
Oh, that's a bad man. That's a bad man.
He's a bad man. Yeah, that's my dude. And he was telling me, going out with you, he was like, yeah, Dougie, he would work out before the show. He always tells me, he's like, yo, Doug, work out or you'll run or whatever for the show.
Right.
You shower, kind of have your time, and then you do it.
Right.
So
he speaks
highly of you, man.
Well, I think when you mentioned, when we mentioned meditation earlier, what I do know is the sort of common factor, the reason why people jog, the reason why we work out. The reason, you know, I've said in past episodes about like advanced breathing techniques and sexual activity, like anything that causes
you. It's all
you,
breathing. That's right.
Yes. Anything that causes you to breathe like it's your last breath.
Somehow
your mind goes into another, which is, I know this is weird to say. I kind of want to know. I don't want to know, but I do want to know what the mind state is to a person that's about to drown. Because I almost drowned.
That's how I came up with this. As a kid, I almost drowned. I almost drowned at Central Park Lake. Me and two of my friends took a little boat. We took one of them little boats. We was cutting school. They talked me into it. And I jumped on the boat with him, and we didn't even have oars. We were pushing out with a little log. And then all of a sudden, he heard the siren. So he knew we weren't supposed to be doing nothing. So he had fear. He jumped into that water. He started swimming. And so when he jumped, the boat pushed back. Then all of a sudden, the other one was there. I said, man, I ain't jumping in that water. Come on, me and you, let's just roll back. And all of a sudden, he was like, yo, come on, man, come on. So his fear, he transferred it to his cousin. His cousin jumped out the boat, started swimming. Then he said, dog, come on, man. The cops is going to get us. I'm telling you, the cops are going to get you. You know, here we are, young. I said, man, I don't care what he say. I'm rowing this damn boat. And, you know, so I get close to the shore. I think that I'm close enough. He's panicking. I allowed his fear to get in me. I jumped in the water. I'm doggy paddling. I'm saying, this is close enough. I think I'm good. And I put my feet down under me thinking that the ground was there.
Oh,
it wasn't no ground. It wasn't no ground. It wasn't no ground. And I started panicking.
No ground, Monty.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, and then my man came in and he grabbed me and pulled me in, right? And when he pulled me in, I'm spitting the water up. So now when I go to the pool, and this is a real story, I'm over here. Everybody's in the 5 feet, 6 feet, you know, summertime pool is where everybody at. The girls, right. I'm over in the little 4 feet or the 3 feet sitting in there with my feet in the water. I'm just shook. I'm shook like to a point. It was crazy. Then I said, yo, I can't live my life like this. This is crazy. I said, this is not even, this make me feel crazy. Every time I'm getting in water, I'm shook. So then one day I went to Hawaii to go do a show because this was going on for a while. I got in Hawaii and the dude was sitting out on a raft. And my sound man said, yo, come swim out, man. Yo, come out here. So all of a sudden I said, all right, I got to break this. I jump in the water and I swim out. I get to the raft. He sit there, talk to me, ask me like two different things. He said, well, I got to go. I'm jumping off the raft. He jumped off the raft and he swims back to the beach. I'm sitting there going, damn, this is crazy. I got to go all the way back now. So I jump in the water and I start swimming. And when I start swimming, I stop. And then I lay in the water and I'm floating. And I said, wow, now I get it. I said, the reason why I almost drowned is not because I can't swim. It's because I panicked.
Yes.
And when I panicked, it took everything out of me. It made me not think. It just made me just have so
tired.
Much fear. Yeah, yeah. Right. It took everything out of me. And I said, if I relax, if I breathe, and if I trust myself, mm-hmm. and if I allow this to make sure that that fear is not there, then it's not as hard. And that lesson is the lesson that I have applied in every aspect of my life. From that time that I drowned to the time that I discovered that. And then I learned that when you run, even when you're breathing, most people stop running because they panic when their breathing is getting cut short.
Right.
So the key is to think and focus on the breathing and then you relax. The same way if a person is, you know, you're going into a stressful situation, you have to relax and then the energy will flow. And I hate to say it like this too, but we keeping it real on this little calm. Y'all took me to a level indeed. That I didn't even think we was going to talk. But even if you're using the bathroom, bro, if you don't relax.
You got to relax. Yes. You're right. Don't clench.
Go.
And there's that clip, ladies and gentlemen. Dougie Fresh, right. On Questlove Supreme.
No, you sitting there like this. You sitting there like this. I don't want nobody to hear me. I don't want nobody to see me. And then you be like, all right, I ain't gotta go. You see what I'm saying? But until I'm keeping it so real, and I know y'all know it's true, that if you don't relax, yo, if you don't relax, it's crazy. So yeah. that's a big part.
It really is.
Of controlling fear. You can't control fear unless you relax.
We got to get to the show eventually.
Oh, he's just growing up right now.
But I do have one question. You mentioned a legendary Harlem figure that I don't know anything about besides his record labels. But could you please, like, we've heard everything about Jersey and Sugar Hill with Sylvia and Bobby.
The Robinsons. Yeah.
In Jersey. But a lot of people don't know that the Bobby Robinson that runs Enjoy Records is another Bobby Robinson. I know nothing about, and you know, I'm a fan of The Godfather of Harlem, and Bobby Robinson's character.
Oh, he's in this season?
Yeah, he's been, Bobby Robinson's sort of been a figure in the first and the second season. He owns a local record store, obviously.
Oh, okay, I saw the first season. I didn't see it. Okay,
right, so obviously, you know, like, I can see, like, you own a record store, and then you start your label, yada, 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 woo. But can you talk about Bobby Robinson and what he meant to the community of Harlem, like, and your dealings with him? Like, what was he like?
Bobby Robinson was a very mild-mannered, low-key, community-friendly guy who was not a very big guy, but he was a guy that all of us respected because he had his own record shop. You would go to his record shop. He had the mom-and-pop record shop, and you would hear everything that came out from the Treacherous Three, from the Fearless, from Cool Kyle, from anybody, from Funky Four. And he was the first guy out there doing it. But the problem is that in the community, Bobby Robinson was also known as a guy who did not pay. And he did not pay no rappers. So when I did the deal with him, I got some money up front from him because I knew, based on the history of what he did with the truck, I used to sit in Bobby Robinson record shop and watch Treacherous Three come in there. And L.A. would be like, yo, where Bobby, man? I'm looking for my money, man. I would watch Mo D come in. Yo, is Bobby in here? Yo, where's he at? And I would watch how people respected Bobby because he was the guy who looked like he knew more than us. We were kids. But it looked like he didn't either explain what was going on or he was doing things and didn't really come clean on what he was doing. Okay. You understand?
Okay, so 1981 and I get a deal with Enjoy Records. How's the deal brokered? Like, what is
how's
an okay
done?
Or fair deal for yeah. Enjoy Records? Are you giving me, and you're Bobby Robinson, are you giving me and my crew like $500 to do one side, or like what kind of deal am I striking with you if you're Bobby Robinson? I want to make a rap record.
Bobby Robinson is not giving you a deal where you really know what you're going to get. You might get 10 cent a record. You might get 12 cents a record or 15 cents a record, but he is not sitting down with a lawyer and going through a deal with you. He know you're a hungry young kid who could rap, and he's just trying to put the record out, and he's saying, yo, here, sign this, and we're going to work it out, and there's no way for you to take account to how many records he sold because he's selling them out the trunk or he's passing them around as to mom and pop distribution. Bobby Robinson was a guy that, for me, I watch every hip-hop artist that he had signed from Grandmaster Flash to Funky Four to Treacherous Three and Fearless Four. I watch all of them. He had them all, and he never dealt with them in a way that they felt confident that they were going to get compensated for their music. And with me, I just did one single with them, two-sided, because I did Get Fresh Doug on the other side, because right. I needed to have something out because I seen what was going on in regards to people believing that I might have got it from Fat Boys, which originally was Disco 3. So when I got with him, it was only for strategic purposes. It wasn't, I knew that Bobby Robinson was not a guy that would pay you. And he was not a guy that you could see yourself making money with.
So you went with Enjoy just so that you could stop the bleeding of the Fat Boys being the sole creators of the beatbox. Like, I right. gotta get in the, okay, I get it's it now.
Marketing.
Right, yeah. right. So I strategically, I said, if I hit him with the movie, if I hit him with Just Having Fun and Get Freshed Up, because remember I said, for all the sounds you beatboxers are doing, all you bit from me, I should be suing. Some say yay where they should be booing. From the time you hear this rhyme, your career is ruined. That's the way I opened it up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then, and so once I did that, it was to make people know. And then out in Long Island in 82, I met Biz. And then I would have Biz with me everywhere because Biz was coming to my house. And he was going to the store for my mother. He was going to the store for my grandmother. And he was up under me because he was trying to learn to beatbox. So I had him there.
You taught and Biz how to beatbox?
Yes, Biz is one of the members, the first members of the Get Fresh crew.
Did not know
Biz,
this.
You forgot to tell us that, Biz.
Yeah, rest in peace. That's my brother. I love him. He's on this new album that I just let out.
Yeah, the last verse from Biz.
That was one of our last times together. Wow. And he's family. You know what I mean? So, and then eventually, and then it got a little weird because he's trying to do the beatbox. I'm doing it. And I'm like, yo, Biz, you know, you biting straight up. I can't let you do that, bro. I can't. And then he's like, all right. And then that's when he went to Magic, but I was with Magic first. But Magic was trying to get me to battle everybody. So I didn't like that. I didn't like how Magic was trying to get me to go in there and battle every single person that he had that he didn't like. Because he was getting high at the time, and he wasn't the same Mr. Magic from WHBI. You know what I mean?
Doug, one more Enjoy era question that I got to know about. You know, because I come from a lineage of musicianship, you know, and all respect to Keith LeBlanc and Doug Winbush of Sugar Hill.
You talking about Pumpkin, baby.
But I gotta know about Pumpkin. So for our listeners that don't know, Pumpkin was the, you know, for Keith LeBlanc and Doug Winbush to be the house band of Sugar Hill Records over at Enjoy Records up in Harlem.
Right.
The leader was Pumpkin, the drummer. And, you know, if you're a beat head, you know, if you collect records, then his interpolation of Tower Power Squib Cakes was done, I think, even better. You know, I prefer Love Rap by Spoonie G, that break, more than the original break that it should have came from. Can you tell me anything about, I knew nothing about Pumpkin. What was he like?
Let me tell you about
the original
Pumpkin.
Right.
Pumpkin was unbelievable. One day, and this is what happened with Bobby Robinson, and this is what made me do it like I did it. Pumpkin was in there, and I told him a beat I wanted him to play. He'd play the beat. He'll go to the keyboards. I said, give me this sound. He'll go in there. He'll pick up the sound. If you needed him to play the bass, he'll grab the bass and put that in there. Pumpkin was like a one-man
band.
And what happened, and if you listen to Love Rap, when it's going, that beat, and then if you hear in the back, you hear the percussions, that's Spoonie G's brother, and his name is Poochie. All of them little coons.
Poochie was his brother?
Poochie is Spoonie G's brother.
Never knew that.
This thing runs so deep. But Pumpkin, and before Pumpkin passed, Pumpkin came to the studio and he kept saying, Dougie, let me play a beat for you tonight. Come on, Dougie, me and you, let's go back to back. Let's do a beat. And in the middle of everything going on, before me and him were able to get together, he passed away. But Pumpkin was a guy that's why he did the song Pumpkin and the All-Stars.
Yeah.
If you remember that one. Because Pumpkin, and if you
have singing that?
Oh, that was his kid named Fly Todd.
I thought he was Michael Jackson.
We are the fucking All-Stars. That's crazy, right? That's crazy.
Wow.
Hey, look, Pumpkin was honestly, as a drummer, as a musician, He was a guy that you could tell your ideas to, and he would be able to give you the idea just like you wanted it and add some things that was really, really good. So my first record I was going to do was a song with Pumpkin, but we never got to finish it.
I was going to say, because if it wasn't for Pumpkin passing away, would you have worked with Teddy Riley for the show in 1985? If Pumpkin were still alive, would you have gone to Pumpkin instead of Teddy Riley?
I would have probably went to Pumpkin, but also I was teaching Teddy about hip hop because Teddy was from the
church kid. Yeah.
Right. So we used to cut school, and that's when I introduced him to swing. Wow. And that was the beginning of it because the drums, you know, let me talk to you as a producer now. Like on the DX or the DMX, the button in the back would determine how much swing that you put into a beat.
Right.
If I'm going, that's swinging. Run DMC's beat used to be like, now it's more like, right, like action. So what I brought was, so that swing. And right. I did it because Greg G from the Disco 4 owed me some money because I did a show for him because he was a promoter on the side. And because he owed me money, he lent all of his equipment to Teddy. And when he lent it to Teddy, he said, yo, man, I ain't got the money right now, but yo, if you want to work on your music and you want to get your joint done, yo, I got the equipment over there at Teddy's house. I said, really? He said, yeah. So I went over there. Teddy had all of his equipment over there. And right over there is when I started to make up the pattern of this show, the drums. And then that's when I hit that shaker. And
How many tracks were you, like, what equipment made the show?
I used the DX drum machine, and I used a series of keyboards because my manager was the one in the studio that played everything. Because it's just a complicated story, man. But the truth of the matter is that I know that the show would have never became what it is if I didn't have Teddy there to be able to express my ideas the way that I expressed them. You know what I mean?
And I was going to say, the show is one of the most unusual formatted songs I've ever heard, because if you really break down the show is almost like, I wouldn't say interludes, but I would almost say seven vignettes, because nothing repeats twice. Like the here we go, come on. It's almost like
a bunch of hooks all jammed together.
Every part could be a hook.
Mm-hmm. Right. Every four bars is a hook.
Yeah. And I know you guys aren't dealing with like Pro Tools. And okay, cut these four bars. So it's almost like I feel like you had to map out that entire song.
How are y'all
song.
Sequencing this shit? Yeah.
I did. I went over there. I sat down. And this is when I first learned how to count the bars and arrange it. So I sat down and I arranged the whole thing. And when I arranged it, I went over to his house after I made up the track. Because this is how y'all understand this, because y'all are musicians and y'all know the game. You go there, you feel the music, and you make it up. After you make it up, I would take the tape home and then I would, you know, play around with it. I'll go to Will's house, Barry's house, then I'll come back and say, I like this. And so I just structured it where I want the horn to hit here. I want this to be it. And I learned how to structure it based on how many bars everything was on the song. And then after it was all done, then I had to go back and program the drums so I can separate all of these pieces.
So you were cutting and pacing?
No, I just programmed it like that. I told Teddy what I wanted to do, and he knew how to work the equipment. And so he sat down, and whatever I was asking him to do, he would do it. I'll say, like, Teddy was the one who came up with the drum roll. So, because I was doing a drum roll, and mine was cool, but then, and he heard mine, and it was, and his is like a combination of what I was doing and what he added to it, which made it better. So the other part, that any contribution that anybody was trying to make to the song, if it felt good and if it worked, it didn't matter who came up with it. It was about making this thing as hot as it could be. Like when I hit the shaker by accident because I was looking for something else. And then when I hit the shaker, I just started to, you know, because I'm doing the beatbox and all of that. I started really moving it. And then when I was working with the drum machine, Teddy, I said, I want swing in it. And he was like, okay. And he put a little, I said, no, I got to swing harder than that. And then he started, I said, no, I got to swing harder than that. I said, that's it right there. That's swing. And nobody was using it.
Man.
Not like that.
I'm going to tell you, to be alive and of age in 1985, I'm probably the last human that got on the train of the show right before it took off, because I spent the entire summer of 1985 in California, where it was all about Toddy T's Bataram.
The Bataram.
I remember Bataram. The Bataram.
Right.
The Bataram.
So
I remember that joint. I remember
like,
that joint.
Yeah, my cousins were bangers, whatever. Like, and literally that's all you only heard, Bataram. So to spend June, July, and August in California, in Altadena, Pasadena, with my teenage cousins, only hearing Bataram. I come back home to Philly, and this is how I know that 1985 was probably the last regional year for hip hop, where like only regions, you only dealt with their regions, and it wasn't like fully national yet. And I got home and saw, you know, my plane landed like 3-4 in the afternoon. Got home, and I remember like talking to the kids on the block. And I just knew I was up on something that they weren't up on. And I was like, yo, y'all know about Bataram? Now, I'm from Philly.
Right.
They looked at me like I was an alien. They're like, what the hell is a Bataram? I'm like, yo, right. I'm a Bataram. You can't stop me. I'm singing the first verse and everything. They just looked at me like, it was like the block was laughing at me.
Yeah.
They're like, nah, we only know about the show and Lottie Dottie. And I was like, the what? Right. Did not know about this. Literally, this is like 2 days before school started. Mm-hmm. And they told me, nah, this has been number one on Power 99 for 3 months in a row. Like,
right.
That's the last time I felt so late on something that the whole world was up on.
You still had till 1991 to get back on it again. Cause I was gonna say, did the New Jack City, I wanted to know the story between on the New Jack City situation and how it became kind of that scene and in that movie, and how you even allowed them to use it. Yeah, because I felt like when it came back into Ninja City, it just gave it new life.
Well, yeah, I mean, the show never died. I think but it gave it more timeless.
No doubt.
Yeah.
For starters, I guess we should ask you, how did you hook up with Slick Rick to start this group?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Slick Rick was, well, he wasn't Slick Rick. He was Ricky
MC
D.
MC Ricky D.
Right. He was right. Ricky D. And he was with his crew that, man, y'all asking some questions, man.
The Kango crew. Right?
Well, yeah, it was the Kango crew, but where I seen him, see, the Kango crew was in his school.
Okay.
Where he was doing his thing was up at the Cadet Club in the Bronx. Now, Rick was moving around with different guys trying to get his hip hop thing going on. And there was a guy named Donald D, and there was another dude named June Love.
Donald D down with Ice T?
Ice T, the Rhyme Syndicate, Donald D?
No, this is another guy, and he calls himself now Dandy Dawn. He's still alive, right? But it was these three guys, me and Tito. was hanging out one night. Tito came by my house from the Fearless Four. And we hung out and we went uptown and they had an MC contest. Now, I was known to take a lot of MC contests because my style was basically the new thing with the beatbox. I'm rhyming, it's crowd participation, I'm dancing, it's Harlem. It's a whole nother thing. There's melody. So it was a new dimension of hip hop coming in. Long story short, me and Tito got on and the girls love Tito. So it was like, let's go get this money, Tito. But then they said we couldn't be in it because they looked at him as a professional and they looked at me as a professional, even though I didn't have a record out at the time, nothing major. But this is, so Rick, June Love and Donald D was in the contest. So when they was in the contest, the Cold Crush Brothers was in the contest too. So this is how the story go. I was there watching Rick, watching June and watching him. I said, yo, these dudes is nice. I said, yo, Tito, look at them, they nice. And he was like, yeah. And T La Rock was up there. And he's like, yeah, wow. You know, it's yours. You know?
Yes, sir.
That's a whole nother story. Right, that's a whole nother story. So we up there and then all of a sudden, say, yo, I heard Rick. And so the rhyme that you're hearing him say on the show was the rhyme that I heard him say in the contest. Okay. And so when he said that rhyme in the contest, I said, yo, the kid is nice. Said the kid Donald D was rhyming about a beef patty. And when he bought the beef patty, they burned it and they flipped it on the other side and gave it to him and they tried to hide it. You know what I'm saying? And he wrote a rhyme about the beef patty. I was like, yo, these dudes is ill because I haven't heard nobody rhyme like this, you know? Long story short, June Love was going to team up with Greg Nice. June Love got murdered. So the style that you hear Greg Nice rhyme in is June Love's style.
Okay. So the Greg Nice style of that is based on June Love?
June Love, right. And June Love was a part of Kango Crew.
Okay.
You following me?
Wow. Got it.
Uh-huh. I'm trying to
and then give you another something. Beatboxer, Greg Nice.
Right, but Greg Nice was also under my guidance because the Fearless Four, he wanted to do the beatbox for the Fearless Four because they wanted something to balance out what they wasn't doing. And because I rhymed, do the beatbox. So Greg Nice was another piece that he was going with Fearless Four. So that's my man. All of that, but I'm just telling you, he started to transition into the June Love style because he was going to do the beatbox for June Love. But when June Love lost his life, Greg basically took the style and then he went forward with it. So while all that was going on, Rick seen me get on and then I'm doing parties throughout the whole city. So everywhere I go, Rick is like, yo, Dougie Fresh, man, yo, you think you could put me on with you? I said, yo, I got to hear you, man. I got to hear you all night, you know, see if you're good, whatever. You know, I said, yo, you seem like a cool dude. He said, yeah, man, my name is Ricky D, man. I said, yeah, I seen you downtown, man. That rhyme you said was kind of slick. He said, yeah, man, I'm nice. So I would go all of these different places and I would see him. He would be pressing me. Like everywhere I go, I'm in the door. He's like, yo, Doug, put me on. I get off stage and then he'll be standing there. He'd be like, yo, I seen you get on, man. Yo, you think we could go back on? You could put me on with you? And I'll be like, I can't do that, man. I just got off. And one day I'm going down the hill in Convent Avenue in Harlem. And I see him on the phone. I don't know how. He was on the corner on a phone while I'm walking down the hill. The odds is like 1,000,000,000 to 1. Mm-hmm. I take him over to Will's house. I got this little drum machine, the RX-7, that I got from OC. From Fearless Sport, one of his DJ, because it was Crazy Eddie and OC. OC was trying to sell me the drum machine. So, you know, when you were broke, you trying to borrow somebody's drum machine and trying to get as most out of it as you can. And then, you know, you got to, you know, they stress you, then you give it back. You know how that was. So Rick came over and I said, yo, Rick, come over to the house, man. And then right then and there is when I said, yo, let me see what you got. So I got on, a couple of other dudes got on, and that was the day that he started Lottie Dottie. And when he said it, he couldn't even finish the rhyme because we was laughing for at least an hour. I mean, it was like, yo, let me tell you something, bro. Rick was so goddamn funny. I'm talking about like he was hilarious. I mean, to the point that we all in there holding our stomach. He can't finish the rhyme. Then all of a sudden, at the end of the rhyme, he say, "I told you I was nice. I told you I was nice."
Wait, are there any other takes of Lottie Dottie that we've not heard? Because it's just
there's a couple. Are there
alternative takes of it?
Nah. What we did on Wax was when we made that. That was because my manager at the time said, "Yo, why don't y'all do that thing called Lottie Dottie that all the kids are talking about in the street?" Because Lottie Dottie was created in 84. And what I did is when I heard the rhyme, I said, "Yo, this rhyme would be crazy if I did the beatbox and I just come in with different words and I change the beat so that it doesn't get boring." And mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah, this will be good." And then all of a sudden, and then he was excited. I said, "And we could take all the rap contests." He was like, yeah, that's what I want. Cause he felt that he got jerked when he was at the cadet corps because they didn't win.
Right.
So he had this big thing on his shoulder saying, "I'm taking every contest." So then we started going around in the city, just taking every contest. And then when we did it on record, we took out the second part to Lottie Dottie because we mentioned Vanessa Williams.
Vanessa Williams. Oh, the yeah. Hold me, never yeah, let yeah, me go yeah, yeah. until yeah. you told hold me. Told Wait me. A minute. Wait a minute. God, this is like the rabbit hole of life. I just got to. Do you have any of those tapes from?
Of course.
Okay. I'm coming to your crib.
Of course.
More than the 12 inch, there was again a Philadelphian. There was a dude, my go-to cheesesteak guy. Every Sunday, my go-to cheesesteak guy.
I love it. I like.
He would have like he had cousins from New York that always put him on to like those T Connection tapes and those Harlem World tapes. So right. when I'm you know, Sunday after church, my routine, I get a cheesesteak after church and he's always playing some live whatever. And one of these Sundays he had like, much to my mom's dismay, this is the first time I'm hearing Treat Her Like a Prostitute, the live version.
Right.
And I snuck back. I was like, "Mom, I'm going to get some potato chips. I'll be right back." And I snuck up to him. I said, and I had one of those, like my mom's, you know, you always record over your mom's tapes or whatever. And right. I had like one of her old, one of the gospel tapes that she just brought from church. God. And was like, God. "Yo, can you make me die this and I'll be back tomorrow for lunch." And I lived with, it's a live version of you two just doing your whole routine. And I studied that shit till the tape popped. It popped and I gotta get that back again. But.
Yo, that's crazy you saying that. I mean, you know, see, When we treat him like a prostitute, we were already doing that. And that was going to be the next thing we was going to let out and some other things that we had. Right. But what's crazy is when I heard Jay and them do it with the beat, it changed the whole vibe of it. It wasn't like the same.
Oh, it wasn't the same.
Yeah.
Like, I'm probably the only person that I heard it, I was like, "Oh, man, I don't want it with music. I want it with Dougie."
Right. But so, you know, it's crazy. It's real like that. And that's interesting because, like I said about frequency, going back to that, it was a matching of a frequency. You see? See, when you doing the beatbox, people think it's easy or simple. It's like the way if you're playing the drums, you're playing to align your spirit with the person that you're playing for. You're not playing like a drum machine. You're playing like a spirit. So when they doing this and that, you got to flow. So what Lottie Dottie is, it's a match him and to move with him and to make him be the best he can be. It wasn't about me. It was about how can we make this be the best? And I had to match the way the energy move. If I don't match the way the energy move, you're just liking me. But I don't just want you to like me. I want you to like what's going on. I want you to feel it. So it has to move. You know what I mean? And that's how, that's the reason why I treat him like a prostitute live. It's better than the drum machine.
Yes, it is. How? Okay, so by September, first of all, let me just declare that I probably think that the show Lottie Dottie is one of the greatest 12 inches of all time. For any,
I appreciate
facts.
That.
I'm afraid to ask. I pray the answer is yes. I hope you still own your publishing for Lottie Dottie because it's probably the most sampled song of in hip hop history.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. But not only do I own all of the publishing, I made sure Rick owns his publishing. And the other side of the story, which only a Questlove and the Supreme team could get, is when I made the show, Quest, when I did Just Having Fun, I called it Just Having Fun because I was learning about the studio and I knew Bobby Robinson wasn't going to pay nobody. So I wasn't going to try to do everything that I could do with him. That was number one. Original Human Beatbox was with Ventertainment Records and Vincent Davis. I had an argument with him because I made the beat up and he put that bing, 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 bing sound in there. And it sounded like a toothpick. I hated it.
Man, I love that shit.
I hate it. And you know, I'm going to tell you, I love the guitars, but I hated that sound because I had a different idea that I felt was better. And me and him got into a conflict. So that vocal was just a practice, a rough vocal on what I was getting ready to come back and do better. So then I left the studio and I started doing shows. I stacked up all my money. And when I went in there, I made the show and Lottie Dottie. And when I told Rick about the show, he said, that idea is whack. That ain't going to work. So then I said, Rick, I said, trust me. I know what I'm talking about. The same way I told you that this beatbox thing is going to work with this routine. So then what happened, he trusted me and we went into the studio and I made the show and I made Lottie Dottie. I took it to Profile Records. Profile Records heard it. He said, this is the worst music I've ever heard. He said, who's that guy sounding like that? And what's this little clicking sound that I keep hearing in the song? So he said it to me. And I said,
Who was it at Profile? Was it Corey or was it Steve?
It was the owner, Corey, I believe.
Corey Robbins. Yeah.
Right. So listen to this. So afterwards, I said, no problem. Now, I paid all the money. I spent 10. I had saved up 10 grand. I went to Daily Planet Studio in New York. So then after that, I went and I said, man, I got to get this record out. So I took it to WHBI. Jerry Bloodrock played it. And a couple of other guys, they started getting a crazy buzz. So I went to this label called Dania Records.
Dania, yeah.
Right, it was a distributed by Fantasy. So when I went to him, I said, he said, yo, I want to distribute the record for you. I said, that's cool. I said, but I'm going to own it. He said, well, I want to buy into the ownership. I said, if you want to buy into the ownership, you got to give me the money back that I spent, we can go from there. So then what he did is he gave me the money back, and then basically I owned the master, and I brought him in, and I gave him a piece of the master. So in 85, I was the first artist to ever own their master. You see, but I learned that because of what happened over there in Joy, and I watched it. So when I owned the master, then I came back and when I gave Rick half of the publishing on the show and we both split half of the publishing on Lottie Dottie. And then from there we moved forward. And then now,
so was that Reality Records? Was that you? Was that your Reality Records?
Yeah. See, it went from, and by the way, and every record after that, I owned the master. So, it was right. So what happened is that I was seeing what was going on. And, you know, I'm like around 17 years old, 18 years old, but I'm seeing that something just didn't seem right about how people are owning your master. Like, I thought that was kind of crazy. And then since I spent the money, I was like, how are you going to own it? So now the record blows up. I go to Roxy. Corey is in Roxy. The The record is on fire. I mean, bro, when I say fire, I mean fire.
Yes.
So now Corey comes in there and he say, yo, could I talk to you? I say, sure. He said, yo, man, I made a mistake, man.
Oh,
I
was did you wrong.
He said, I was wrong. He said, man, this thing, I just couldn't see it coming. He said, I was just seeing Run DMC. I couldn't see nothing. This was just so unusual. It was so new. It was so, I didn't know what to think. I said, bro, I said, it ain't no problem. I was just giving you the first opportunity because you got the label. I said, it's okay. He said, yo, man, is there any way that we could do something else? Are you signing anybody? I said, well, I got a deal where I got my masters and I'm also with the label, but it's a great deal. I got my publishing, I got the masters. I said, but maybe we could down the road. And then after, he got Dana Dane because he wanted the same label.
Wow, that makes all the fucking sense. Cinderella, yeah, Dana Dane with Fame, that album, yeah, Cinderella, Dana Dane, Nightmares, all that shit.
Right, right.
Wow.
And we didn't mind because Dana was a part of the family. You know what I mean? But I'm just showing you how sometimes, once again, it's back to that fear. He told me my records was garbage. I was like, okay, no problem.
So this leads to my follow-up question. You two have undoubtedly created one of the, and this is not even a thing where it's like time has to pass by before we know it's a classic.
Right.
But it's like y'all just hit us with these two singles and then nothing else. Now, of course, with you, like, yes, I realized that Oh My God came out in 86. So you did come up with an album. But why
they came back? They did Sitting in My Car. They did come back. They did Sitting in My Car.
Yeah, but like,
yeah, that was like
14 years later.
10 years later,
he was going to prison. Yeah.
Why? No, but even before prison, what was happening with Slick Rick between 1986 and 1989 before he signed to Def Jam? Like, why didn't he capitalize on, you know,
the hottest single
making
ever,
you guys a unit? Like, was that just a one-off deal and okay, Rick, I'll see you later?
Nah, what happened was is that, to the blame of us both, I felt that, once again, like I said, I was already established in the street. I was moving around. I took Will and Barry and I brought them together. And that was the first time, again, with two DJs DJed together at the same time. There's never been a crew before the Get Fresh crew with two DJs DJed at the same time. The Get Fresh crew is the foundation to the Executionist because no, I had two sets and they playing at the same time, not you get on after me. So I was really always trying to push something new. The beatbox was new. I had my guys there. I brought Rick in here. And what happened with me and Rick was, you know, I felt that he was accusing me of doing something that I didn't do. He was accusing me of not, he felt like I was trying to make all the money or something. And that's not true. I gave him half of the royalty. I gave him half of the publishing. I gave him a really good salary while he was on the road. And also the other DJs, I had a manager, I gave him 20%. The agent, I gave him, you know, the 10% because he was booking the shows. I had all of these different expenses. And everybody had to, you know, get a salary. And on top of that, I put him in on what was already in motion. And I didn't like how we were like this, you know what I'm saying? And then when I started to see how people was getting in his head and people was coming in trying to get into my head, I didn't really like the energy. So I said, I got to pull out of this. And I didn't want no money. I didn't want no producer or no override or no finder's fee. I was like, bro, you go ahead and do what you got to do because the energy is not feeling good no more. And I think we got too much love for one another. I felt that the magic we was creating is because, once again, He trusted me. I trusted him. And when I felt that there was a violation of him trusting me, it bothered me. And I was young. And I should have just allowed him to express that. But I took it personal. And I just said, yo, you go do your thing. And then when he went over there, Russell sat him on the bench for multiple years. And if we being real, it's because, you know, at that time, he didn't really know what to do with him. And I over there at Def Jam, everybody was happy, but not so happy because we were a little bit of a threat to people because of the dynamics of all of the things that we were bringing together. But I love Rick, so I didn't want nothing but the best for him. And I just felt like, you know, if the energy is not right, it doesn't make sense for us to go any further.
Was there any conversation or reach out to you to do anything on The Great Adventures of Slick Rick? Like, did nah, Russ call you and say, yo, will you do something? Or
no, they tried to, they didn't call me, but they tried to put me in it, because if you listen to maybe 6 or 7, 8 songs, my voice is throughout the whole album. So they were trying to balance out the formula of what it was that we created together. So when people are listening to that album, they're hearing his brilliance and the excellence of the production, but they're also feeling my frequency in there in a subtle way, because I'm in there, you know, and I'm in multiple songs. So they were trying to figure out how to bring him where he needed to be. And I look at it like this too, to be completely transparent. I think that it was necessary because Great Adventures of Slick Rick gave him the platform to express things that I think was important for him to express. And we probably could have figured it out, but I think that would he have been the what I call the greatest storyteller? Could he have been that with me? Mm-hmm. And could I have been the entertainer that I have grown to become? Because maybe it would have been too much force from two different, you know what I'm saying, two different energies, and it would not really have been as great as it could have been. And you know, I just know that, like, and then when he was about to go to prison, because he knew it was happening, mm-hmm. I went up to New Rochelle, and Vance Wright was up there, and I said, let me hear some of his music, man. And he played something, and I heard Sitting in My Car, and I said, nah, y'all got a drum machine, pull that out. And he was getting ready to do the same thing that he did with Jam Master Jay. I said, let me do it. And then I put it in there. And then I kept the loop in there. And then when he got out of prison, after doing a long, long, rough ride, I was there for him to perform with him when he got out in L.A. And I did that for him to support him. You know what I mean? And then I had the senator go up and, you know, make sure he didn't get deported. And then when the senator became the governor, I brought the governor in, because I felt like even though we're not together, we're always together.
All right, y'all. I know you want some more, and we got it for you. That was part one of Questlove Supreme's interview with Dougie Fresh. You ready for part two? All right, stay tuned. It's coming up.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.